We have chosen a rather interesting subject, which was probably more familiar 100 years ago than it is today. But in those times, the approach was quite different. And we have certain knowledge and understanding which was not available to our ancestors. About the year 1380, there was born in a little town called Kempen near Dusseldorf in Germany, one Thomas, who became known as Thomas of Kempen, or later Thomas a Kempis. Fortunately, we have some biographical information about Thomas. And we know that for his time, he enjoyed extraordinary longevity. He died in 1471 at the age of 91 years. And to make that in the 15th century was rather good, especially without benefit of vitamins and other helpful elements. One of the reasons, possibly, why Thomas a Kempis lived so long was that he lived so quietly. Of his 91 years, he spent over 70 in a cloister. As a result, he is often described as one of the most unworldly of mortals. He had almost no contact with the ordinary everyday life of working, struggling, striving persons. However, in his day, the German monastic system was still rather sketchy. And the little monastery of St. Agnes, of the Order of St. Augustine, was one of the poor monasteries. It was up to the brethren of this group to find their own way in life and to find such means as they could to survive and preserve their institution. This they accomplished by gaining wide recognition as copyists of manuscripts. They copied all kinds of documents and papers for illiterate princes, rulers. Kempis himself actually made one complete copy or transcription of the entire Bible. These brothers, therefore, by supplying books, psalmsters, antiphonals, and other necessary parts of the religious life of the times, managed to maintain their way of life. Of these copyists, Thomas a Kempis was one of the best. He worked with the quiet, careful way of the detached religious person of his time. In many instances, he signed his copies as copyist. He certainly made no effort or had no intention of claiming any particular credit other than the fact that he made these copies. During this long life also, he wrote a number of books. Most of these books were as unworldly as his own career. And the majority of his little tracts and productions were in the strange, cramped style of a copyist. He wrote brief essays on the conduct of monks, on the regulation of a monastery, and on such subjects as keeping its gardens in order and the buildings in repair. He was advanced to prior at one time, but found this too much of a strain and responsibility, so he resigned and continued in a comparatively insignificant office throughout his life. He is described by his contemporaries as a very youthful expression and appearance, even in advanced years. Mild-eyed, smooth-skinned, and with the complexion of a small child, even when he was very close to 90. We do not know too many details about him. He was a fair scholar, and for his time had to be comparatively literate in order to take care of the copies of the works that came to the monastery. He also began the accumulation of a small library within the monastic structure. He did nothing of an outstanding or extraordinary nature as far as his conduct was concerned. Sometime about 1430 or 40, a little work came into circulation called The Imitation of Christ. This little book, of very obscure origin, has the distinction of having been translated into more languages and have passed through more editions than any other book in the world, with the exception of the Bible. Now, the comparatively small number of persons who know this work today would make it seem impossible that such could have been the case. But second only to the Bible, The Imitation of Christ has been the bestseller of all time. The earliest copies of the work carried no author's name. They were published or issued anonymously and were so copied. And out of this peculiar conflict of circumstances has arisen a literary controversy, a controversy that is far older and has been fought far more enthusiastically or bitterly than the controversy over the authorship of the Shakespearean plays. Ever since the 15th century, efforts have been made to discover who wrote The Imitation of Christ. Early evidence seems to point very strongly toward Thomas A Kempis. And in the course of time, for the average person and the public in general, the controversy died out. But even as late as the present century, it has been stirred again by scholars who have been unable to reconcile this peculiar and extraordinary work with the life of its presumed author. In the course of trying to solve the work, many early manuscripts were consulted, and the authorship problem was not only complicated but confused to chaos by the result. At the present time, there are 15th century or early 16th century manuscripts or early printed editions of The Imitation of Christ, with over 14 different authors given on the title pages. The runner-up, we may say, or the second choice to Thomas A Kempis himself, was a man by the name of John Gerson. Now, John Gerson has been a wonderful subject for study. He has been examined in every way possible, and he has never even been discovered. No one has ever been able to find him. If there is a controversy over the authorship of the book, there is a still greater mystery around the principal claimant, other than A Kempis himself. It is now suspected that this man, Gerson, was invented, that he never existed at all, but that his name was composed out of abbreviations and notes upon some of the early manuscripts. We do know, however, that even now the authorship of this work is not conclusively assigned to Thomas A Kempis. Therefore, he is the popular candidate at the moment. He seems to retain most of the favor and enthusiasm relating to the book. But efforts to examine and classify early copies and early manuscripts are extremely confusing. And into this confusion has been added certain other factors. Various early religious groups had a great desire to claim this work for themselves. In order to do so, they tried to manufacture authors from their own particular orders, particularly the Benedictines and the Franciscans. So within the cloister itself, quite a tempest arose. It has generally cleared for our thinking now, but the fact remains that the book is totally different from anything known to have been done by Thomas à Kempis. And there is much possibility that he was not the true author. If he was not, it is also possible that the work arose among the remnants of the old Gnostic and heretical sects in Europe, and may even have been spurred into existence by those metaphysical or mystical secret societies who are known to have been just beneath the surface of medieval culture. If we wonder this question, we can also point out some parallels in passing. The famous Shakespearean parallel we do not hardly need to mention. But there is a grave question as to whether Moore wrote his Utopia, because it is totally different from the man himself. He was a highly progressive, socialistic type of publication, coming from one of the most reactionary men of his time, a man whose personal cruelty is almost beyond description. And yet here is a great idealistic book. Another example is the Robinson Crusoe of Defoe. He is supposed to have written the story in 3 days. There is grave doubt. So with all these works, there can be other possible authors. And nearly all of these controversial books are key books in some part of man's struggle for ethical culture and survival. It is therefore quite possible that they were produced by unknown persons for purposes now obvious, but at the same time, in their own day, it seemed useful for them to remain concealed. Although the term or the title of the book, The Imitation of Christ, is really an excellent title considering the treatment, it is one of the most misleading titles that perhaps could have been given as far as the public mind of today is concerned. We always think of imitation as copying. And when we find a book with such a title, we may be inclined to assume that the author attempted to write a fifth gospel or attempted to imitate the style and writing of Scripture. This is not the intent at all and has no part in the procedure. The idea of a facsimile or a reproduction or an imitation could and has gravitated against the general acceptance of the work in some sources. Therefore, it is essential for us to create a certain background and then to examine the book as to its own content. Also, we must bear in mind that back in the 14th and early 15th century, there was a tremendous upheaval within the religious life of Christianity. This upheaval was to affect the entire future of the church. And through the church and the later Protestant Reformation, it was to affect all peoples who hold nominal Christian affiliations or who are brought up in a nominal Christian atmosphere. So much of Western civilization is keyed to this, that we cannot fail to realize that it has affected and influenced practically every development we have had and every step in the unfoldment of Western history. During the time of Thomas A. Kempis, the term imitation of Christ meant only one thing, the personal imitation of the life of Christ. That each individual was to seek his salvation by imitating the conduct of the Master. This is the word, the use and meaning of imitation in this particular usage. There were two very important schools that were struggling for domination in European thinking. One of these schools had to do with a voluntary submission to the historical Jesus as set forth in the Gospels, and the imitation of his historical conduct as the basis of spiritual security. If, therefore, we analyze this, we see, for example, the reason why medieval and early, even earlier groups of Christendom chose the life of solitude, of chastity, of renunciation, of impoverishment, as being the proper way to imitate the teachings and example of the Master. This imitation was to these people the key to a spiritual virtue. They moved upon the hypothesis that in order to understand any subject or matter, we must gain a likeness with it. If we are to understand persons, we must know their experiences through experiencing these things ourselves. This attitude still holds among your penitentiary communities of New Mexico, where the literal imitation of the life of the Messiah constitutes their annual passion play. It was this belief that only through likeness could we come to an inner understanding of the meaning of the ministry. Thus, the various orders of renunciation and repentance. Thus, the various restrictions which have ever been placed upon the Christian life, restrictions regarding pleasures, luxuries, and things of that nature, which were regarded as ungodly. The second school that was also coming into prominence did not outwardly reject the idea of imitation, but changed the concept of it. And it was this change of concept that we begin to find in writings such as those of Thomas A. Kempis. There gradually arose among the medieval Christian mystics the conviction which had already found rooting in the Near East, namely that the true purpose of the faith was to cause the individual to discover a divine mystery within his own nature. That it was not through eye service or physical obedience utterly and completely to a literal historical record, but through a searching within the self for an inspiration arising within the self, and associating this interior inspiration with the Christian mystery. Here then, the old division that began in the separate viewpoints of Peter and Paul is restated. We have the difference, for instance, between what has been termed religious and political ecclesiasticism. The Augustinian group following the work of their founder and his great book, The City of God, actually affirmed the political significance of Christianity. They affirmed that it was the duty of the Christian religion to gradually become the sole proprietor of the conduct of men and to create a spiritual commonwealth on earth. That one by one, all peoples and all nations would come under the rule of Christ. And that in this rulership would be built a utopian civilization. A civilization ruled over by a hierarchy or group representing the Christian faith on earth. This concept went in one direction and went strongly in that way, binding the church into a powerful institution demanding temporal recognition. The other group, equally sincere in its dedications, did not believe this, but held that the kingdom of God is not of this world. They held, therefore, that the journey to salvation is and must always be an individual seeking after reality. That it could not be done politically, but it had to be the result of the individual making his spiritual life important in himself and moving gradually from involvement in material concerns to total absorption in the mystery of spiritual life. This broke the church wide open during the 14th and 15th centuries and ended what has been called the universal church. For from the time of this great break between these two viewpoints, there has never been a healing of the wound, and religion in the Western worlds has always been divided on these two principles. And this division still affects us in our daily thinking, where we are still concerned with religion in politics, religion in education, as distinguished between religion as private belief and private conduct. This occurs and reoccurs, even in our day, indicating that for 500 years, this peculiar division has existed within the structure of our religion. Now, with this background, we can begin to approach the ideas and ideals of Akempis. And we search with him through the very beautiful but austere and severe concepts, no longer thinking of them simply in his terms, because his experience was very different from ours. It is recorded in the old monastery where he lived that he was a man of visions, of strange, mysterious pressures within his own consciousness. Such pressures would not be unreasonable in the case of a person so isolated from the common everyday problems of living. We may depart from the world, but we cannot be sure that all of the world departs from us. And there is usually some measure of conflict in the heart and life of the recluse and the hermit. Even so, we perceive in him some of the values that are important in the modern psychological study of mysticism. And regardless as to whether or not he was the author, the work itself is laden with these values and will require a certain amount of thought toward the end of what can this mean to us and how may it have an effect upon our own daily search for truth. I think we must all agree with Akempis or with the Imitation of Christ on the fundamental premise of the work, namely that man is placed here in order that he may enlarge his inner life, his graces, and his understanding. This seems to be a fairly reasonable statement. It is supportable by everything that we know. For we realize that man is endowed with faculties and propensities beyond those necessary for his physical survival. If man had been intended merely to reproduce his kind and to perpetuate a species of animal upon the earth, then the various faculties, intuitions, inspirations, ideals which he possesses would not have been necessary. In fact, they would have been a further burden upon him. For to burden a being with useless or meaningless attributes is merely to complicate its existence. We are therefore moved to affirm with the mystic theologians of the Middle Ages that man has been given certain abilities, certain instruments of procedure, certain memory, intuition, inspirational factors, visionary extensions of perception, by means of which he stands unique among creations, namely, that he alone, apparently, can dream of a better state for himself and his kind. If this be true, and there is every evidence that it is in every generation, exemplified by the nobility of the great idealists that have ornamented the story of mankind, then the cultivation of these graces, these values, and these powers should certainly be regarded as the legitimate purpose of man. Or, if we wish to be more conservative, we can say a legitimate purpose for man. Some may not feel or assume that they wish to undertake so arduous a program, but that they are capable of such a program and have the basic instruments necessary for it. These cannot be denied. Consequently, motivation becomes a very important factor. And the development of man as a spiritual being, or as a being of ideals and principles, is entrusted, or has been entrusted for a long time, to religion and religious philosophies. There is a very slight differentiation in many instances between theology and philosophy. Particularly, this was true in the pre-Christian world, where these elements mingled almost completely. More recently, however, religion has gained ascendancy in certain aspects, religion being the basis of an enthusiasm or a motivation to make use of these potentials not commonly employed. So Thomas seeks to find out what it is that causes some men to gain a great conviction and others to be deficient in conviction. Why do some persons dedicate their lives to purposes beyond personal profit, gain, or even survival, whereas others are not called to any such dedication, but continue to drift along in the familiar courses of, lukewarmness as to all dynamics? They just do not take part in any special emphasis upon value in any of its forms or kinds. The seeming answer to this is that those who have found a way of life, who have been impelled into a dedication, when asked about it, are not able to explain the circumstance themselves. And this has been a very important element. Most people can tell you why they do not believe. Very few people can tell you why they do. They can give you words, but these words, when stripped of non-essentials, are reduced to a mere phrase or sentence. The individual follows certain impulses within his own nature. He becomes a certain kind of person because he feels like becoming that kind of person. And his feelings are ripened by his experience. But his experience in turn is meaningless unless this experience finds a sympathy within himself. We experience every day interesting and important occurrences, situations. We make discoveries, become informed in matters. And yet, unless these experiences fit into the over pattern of our general conviction, we ignore them, or discard them, or misapply them. Thus, experience can help us to intensify a mood or a decision or a determination. But experience is not usually the basis of this mood or determination. This mood or determination arises in the inner capacity of man and indicates clearly those values and faculties by which he is superior to other creations that we can commonly contact in life. Having thus come to the conclusion that man's spiritual aspiration is essentially the result of an inward movement rather than of an exterior movement, we can say that the man of character is the man moved from within, and the man without character is the man who is moved by everything else except the within. Also, we can say that a person moved from within is moved by a unified force, whereas the person who is moved from the outside is and must be in a state of continual adjustment with conflicting and even contradictory movements, pressures, and incentives. Thomas A. Kempis holds, therefore, that man's desire to grow, to be more than he is, arises not primarily from his intellect, but more directly from his emotions, and also that it is an internal decision to which some arrive at birth, others attain later in years. But the moment of this decision cannot be predicted. It may arise from what appear to be outside circumstances. But if it does, these circumstances cause this chemistry or alchemy by their relation to interior values. Thus, 10 persons placed in the same circumstances will not come to the same conclusions or assume the same responsibilities, because inwardly they are different persons reacting differently to stimuli. On the grounds that the early Christian mystics, that there was a spiritual core or life center in man, they regarded this as the proper explanation for the higher incentives of the individual. That these incentives arose from pure value within himself. And this pure value was the pressure or motion of the divine power in him. By this divine power, he actually exists. For without it, he could not be a living creature. But he is not fulfilled merely by the fact that universal energy sustains his material existence. He is fulfilled only when this body, life, or person is ensouled and becomes truly a living being. Living in the sense of directive, of self-moving, of a being with determination, and this determination essentially dedicated. If this, then, is the idea of the ensouled man, we can come to a definition that is a little different from psychology, but not so different in its principle. Namely, that to be ensouled, an individual has to acknowledge the allegiance of good within himself. That it is his own inner value of good, taking possession of his total life, that constitutes ensouling. Ensouling, therefore, is dedication. It is not the presence in us, by arbitrary circumstances, of a power of good. It is our own decision to permit this power of good to be the leader in our life. And until this decision is made, the soul exists, but does not ensoul the body. A person, therefore, who is outwardly dedicated is a person whose outward nature is ensouled by his inner life. This ensouling is in the form of a mystical sacrament. It is a sacrament which is in itself difficult to explain, for the hour no man knoweth. This ensouling is also a kind of second coming. It is the return of the divine power into management over our lives and affairs. Thus we can begin to see how the two interpretations of religion divide even in their relation to man. The political power of religion is exemplified in the political power of soul over body within the person himself. The city of God of Augustine is therefore also the composite personality of the individual ensouled by God, dedicated to God, and devoted to the works of the divine power. This is one school of thought, and it led toward the life of dedicated service in the world. The individual, so ensouled, so convinced that the spirit moved his body, then made use of the aptitudes, attributes, abilities, powers, and propensities which he possessed, in order to advance the authority of the soul in the world around him. Out of such dedications have come art and music and literature. Also, to a measure, philosophy and more recently science. For whether we assume the conscious process or not, to be the instrument of the soul means to release through ourselves those forces and powers which we regard as commonly beneficial or inclined to advance the common good of all society. Under these conditions, ensoulment creates the busy man. It creates the dedicated doctor. It creates the researcher, the person who in all walks of life has sacrificed personal comfort, personal relaxation and pleasure in order to serve a principle greater than his own personal desires. And nearly everyone who has ever achieved anything in this world has in some way been so dedicated. For it is necessary for us to find a work larger than ourselves in order to find an enthusiasm capable of sustaining the endeavor. Very few persons have ever found happiness or satisfaction merely in the aggrandizement of themselves. They think they're going to, but they do not. Here again, as one authority points out, as early as the 15th century, a strong Buddhistic influence was present in Italy and Germany, and this is something that most folks do not know. This influence had already moved in from the Near East, and was to have further emphasis upon European life as the result of the return of the Crusaders. The Near East had been nourished by the Far East. Your dervishes, Sufis, and Muslim mystics included in their studies and their curricula much of Vedanta, Yoga, and Buddhism. These forces came back into Europe again. And while they were considered, and still are within the body of the church, heretical, they also did exercise a modifying influence upon small groups of mystics. And some of these mystics, although they remained nominally within their faiths, became exponents of essentially Eastern philosophies and religions. Just as Emerson was essentially a Brahmin, although he was a Unitarian minister. In this regard, the second problem began to develop, namely, whether this motion outward into the life of service exhausted the spiritual potential of man. The question that bothered the theologian then, and to a measure still bothers millions of people, is whether the destiny of man is to be achieved by the creation of the perfect commonwealth. If we were able, as a result of several thousand years of the most dedicated religious effort, to create a comparatively harmonious and happy world, assuming this miracle to be possible, and finally did bind people together into a kind of security in which their physical needs were taken care of, in which all of the various necessary elements of life were either socialized or communized to the degree that we had no longer any poverty, that we overcame artificial class distinctions, that each individual was honest in his weights and measures. Well, we can go on with this, but it rapidly approaches fantasy, so we'll pause at this time. Assuming these things to be possible, do they constitute the end for which man was fashioned? Is he supposed to live like the continuance into futurity of the familiar fairy tale? Is he to be happy forever and ever? Actually, life itself seems to point against this. It points against it in the numerous problems which exist wherever socialized life is experienced. It seems to point to the same thing in the fact that man himself, by the very limitation of his own lifespan, cannot think in terms of forever and ever. Also, there is something essentially not quite satisfying in this process of forever building for an unknown futurity. Because if this futurity arises in a different kind of world, its problems must be different, and problems differ with every generation. By the time we have solved the problems of one generation, that generation itself is gone.